looking for middle ground in disputed holy lands.
There's a really strong emotional or political or economic connection in the U.S. to the region, but often there isn't that connection between the voices of Israelis and Palestinians and the voices of Americans.
The Israel-Palestine dilemma and how the American presidential race can muddy the waters. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. One global sore spot that continues to be raw is the question of conflicting land claims by Israel and Palestinians. Its roots go deep, and the political maneuvering on both sides has not helped the movement toward a solution. Yet despite the political distance, studies indicate that the majority of people in Israel and the majority of Palestinians agree on the answer. We've featured reports on Israeli citizens who smuggle Palestinian families across blockades for a day at the beach, and Palestinians who host Israeli citizens in secret outreach meetings, social networking under the radar. There's a group called One Voice that is working to make that majority heard. Rachel Steinberg is International Engagement Programs Director at One Voice, and we recently talked about what One Voice does and the impact of the American presidential race on the ongoing debate. In the headlines, everyone hears one point of view or the other.
Sure.
But there's a middle ground that you can maybe help people understand when it comes to the Israeli-Palestinian situation.
Sure. One Voice is an international grassroots movement, and we were founded in 2002. And we were founded during a time of really increasing hopelessness and frustration. And it's interesting that we're seeing a lot of that again or still 10 years later. And we really work to bridge the gap between the people and the political process. So One Voice works in parallel in Israel and Palestine, which allows us to appeal to both people's enlightened self-interest. And we work to mobilize people at the grassroots level. We work to empower youth to sort of lead the charge and wage the war, so to speak, to bring about peace and a two-state solution. And we work to bring the message of the average citizen up to the political level through direct and indirect political advocacy.
Well, and Rachel, you did bring up the words, the moderate majority.
Mm-hmm.
Do you actually know for a fact that that is the majority?
One Voice actually conducted polls several years ago, and actually, interestingly, at a really difficult political time, right after Operation Cast Lead, and right after Bibi Netanyahu was elected as prime minister. And when we conducted those polls, we found that, indeed, the majority of Israelis and Palestinians are willing to accept the two-state solution. But those numbers were in the 70s range. And by and large, those polling numbers have stayed the same, perhaps in the high 60s, but still hovering just around 70% of both Israelis and Palestinians. But often that is actually a silent majority. And so One Voice is working to amplify those often silent, moderate voices.
Okay, so let me get back to the Jerusalem
Sure.
issue, because it's a hot-button issue that has been one for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
Why would it cause so many problems for an American presidential candidate to say, we're going to move our embassy to Israel into Jerusalem?
Indeed. So I think everything that's been in the media and that's been going on recently speaks to the really important disconnect between Israelis and Palestinians at the citizen level and Americans. There's a really strong emotional or political or economic connection in the U.S. to the region, but often there isn't that connection between the voices of Israelis and Palestinians and the voices of Americans. So any facts on the ground that are predetermined makes the negotiation process that much more difficult to both begin and get through. And both Israelis and Palestinians look to have their capitals in Jerusalem. So predetermining the outcome of that conversation would make negotiations incredibly difficult.
And what about the impact of the statements also made by Governor Romney when he was discussing the parallels between Israeli economic situation and realities for the Palestinian economy? I'm assuming that when he referred to it as a cultural difference, which caused a huge storm, what does that do to the moderate Palestinian and Israeli?
I think it actually really harms America's chances to be the important middle ground broker that it needs to be. Increasingly, there is mistrust in the U.S. as the broker. But at the same time, Americans are already, at the government and citizen level, are so involved in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and in the peace process that they're really the only broker that there can be. So to sort of create a bit of animosity over comments, either that or any other comments made, can be very, very difficult for moving the peace process forward. And again, speaks to the importance of Americans being connected to the reality on the ground. And Israelis and Palestinians have to be making that connection for them. And that's what we do through our international engagement program speaking tours.
And Rachel, I'm assuming One Voice has done some study of how the Obama administration has been perceived in this entire issue. How have they done?
Actually, that's interesting. Our poll isn't quite as recent. When we did our poll in 2009, America was actually viewed as the best broker for negotiations, but we haven't updated our numbers since, although I'm sure others have updated those numbers. But again, through our international engagement program, we're trying to also get average Americans involved in being positive forces for pushing the peace process forward. And that means having average Americans amplify the voices of Israelis and Palestinians to their decision makers here, and also take on and support campaigns that our Israeli and Palestinian youth activists are doing on the ground in the region.
And Rachel, what is the moderate desire for a solution? I heard you say two-state solution, and what about the issue of Gaza and the Palestinian settlements? What is the moderate voice looking for as a settlement?
Sure. So in One Voice, we stand for the two-state solution based on the 1967 borders. And so those borders would form the basis for the establishment of an independent Palestinian state and an end to the occupation. And negotiations would resolve all of the final status issues in accordance with international law and previous bilateral agreements. And that's the platform that One Voice stands on.
And has there been any motion in that direction, or has it actually been negative motion?
In the past, the political players, when they have sat down to negotiations, have certainly focused on the two-state solution as their goal. Unfortunately, they've never quite gotten to the point where that's officially been able to be put down on paper and moved forward with.
So what is the answer for getting those voices heard? Obviously, you're working at it. Have you come up with the magic solution to say, here's how we get these people heard?
I think it's a combination of factors. I think we in One Voice take it on at a couple of different levels. The first thing that we do is build capacity, and we focus on building capacity in young leaders between the ages of 18 and 35, and we train them in skills like conflict resolution and public speaking and leadership and organizing so that they can then take those skills and work within their own communities to spearhead grassroots campaigns or begin conversations. So empowered with those skills, our youth leaders then drive the rest of our process. One important component is a town hall meeting program that we do, particularly in One Voice Palestine, where our youth leaders work to have conversations at the local level to build consensus for the difficult compromises that will come with a final status negotiation process. Then the next level that we work on is creating public awareness campaigns and grassroots mobilization campaigns. So, for example, our youth leaders in One Voice Israel did a very successful video that went viral. Over 12,000 people viewed the video online, and it was because they did a flash mob in a public square where they were advocating for a settlement freeze as a means to unfreeze negotiations and restore confidence in the peace process. And similarly, in One Voice Palestine, they're working also at the grassroots level and particularly the communal level. Some really successful recent events that they've done are tree plantings on land that is slated for confiscation by the Israeli authorities, and to reassert that in order to create a two-state solution or to continue that there could be hope for a two-state solution based on the 1967 lines, that there shouldn't be negative facts created on the ground that make that even more difficult to achieve. And then the last step is, of course, bringing these kinds of campaigns and these kinds of voices to the political leadership, exerting direct political pressure on leaders to take constructive action. And so one example of what we've done quite successfully is One Voice Israel worked with several members of Knesset to establish the first ever, believe it or not, two-state solution caucus in the Israeli Knesset.
And is there a political will in the Israeli government for a solution at this point, or is this a long-range goal?
It's hard to tell. With increasing settlement growth, it's hard to see, although the Israeli government does say continuously that they believe that the two-state solution can and will happen and they support the two-state solution, to see the facts on the ground makes it hard to believe that the Israeli government is committed to a serious negotiations process. And so it's hard to say which voice really wins, both internally and externally for them.
Rachel Steinberg is International Engagement Programs Director at One Voice. Find out more at onevoicemovement.org. Up next, the movement toward human rights in Myanmar and shining shopping malls as symbols of the other Iraq. If you missed part of this show or want to hear it again, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1207. Authorities in Myanmar have taken positive steps to improve human rights, but the country still faces serious challenges, according to a UN independent expert. Tomas Ojea Quintana, Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Myanmar, says although some prisoners of conscience have been freed, he's concerned about the welfare of those still behind bars. He tells Diane Penn the past few years have marked an interesting period in the country's history, starting with the 2010 general elections.
These were very important elections, although we have criticized those elections not to be fair and impartial. But the results of the election is that now a civilian government is in place in Myanmar, and the leadership has been taking consistent decisions in the right directions towards improvement of the human rights in the country.
What are some of the challenges?
I would say a very important challenge is the situation in border areas where the armed conflict is still going on. And we have, for example, the situation in Kachin State. Of course, the government has been doing a lot of progress in this regard towards a ceasefire agreement and starting peace talks with these groups. At the same time, as I said, I think a long-term solution has to be applied, but simultaneously the government should address the human rights abuses during armed conflict. This has been an endemic problem in Myanmar throughout the decades, where the army has been fighting against the non-state armed groups. And in this fighting, the civilians, particularly ethnic minorities, has been suffering the consequences of the armed conflict. And I hope, and I've been discussing with the authorities in the country, that together with the solution in terms of the peace and the ceasefires, there has to be a very concrete instruction to the army that human rights must be respected in armed conflict.
And I wonder if you can tell us about some of these instances of human rights abuses. What's occurring, or what reports have you received?
What has been a common practice is, first, the displacement of villagers by the army, by the battalions, together with the land confiscation. And also, recently I have received reports of kidnappings of villagers and also villagers being killed. This compromises international humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions, and many human rights standards.
In your talks with the government and the other authorities that you've met with, do you see any willingness to try and address these issues and resolve them?
I see a willingness from the authorities in the capital city, in Naypyidaw. One of the problems is to what extent this willingness from these authorities reach the different battalions around the country and the army itself. Don't forget that this is a country that has been under the rule of military for 40 years, and this cannot be changed from one day to another. And also remember, for example, that the parliament, the 25% of the parliament, is integrated by military representatives. So one of the problems is the militarization as a policy. On the one hand, there is a clear willingness, and I'm always glad to hear from the government authorities the willingness to really comply with the international human rights standards. At the same time, the question is implementation, particularly in border areas.
Now, among the many people that you met with was the lady, Aung San Suu Kyi. Tell us, what was that meeting like and what did you discuss with her?
She has been under my attention while she was a political prisoner. Remember that she was a political prisoner for many years. So in this regard, was of my concern as a human rights reporter. Now, she has become a political leader. She's a member of the parliament. And in this regard, it's very important to hear her impressions about this transition to democracy. And how does she see my participation, my role in this transition to democracy? How can a special reporter for human rights can help the transition to democracy to be successful? So these were the kind of discussions that I had with Madame Aung San Suu Kyi. More specifically, I also talked about the remaining political prisoners. The government has taken important decisions in this regard, releasing a large number of political prisoners. However, there are some others who remain in Myanmar prisons, some of them members of the Madame Aung San Suu Kyi's political party, the National League for Democracy. And one other important issue that we discuss is, how does she see the importance of addressing the human rights violations of the past? How Myanmar will face what happened in the past? And this was an important discussion that I had with her, but also with the government authorities and some other stakeholders.
That is Tomas Ojea Quintana, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Myanmar, speaking to Diane Penn of UN Radio. In Iraqi Kurdistan, a common adage says the Kurdish people have no friends but the mountains. Today, the mountains along the northern border of Iraq are sometimes the site of less than friendly fire from Turkish and Iranian forces, while cities south of these giants are the center of economic growth. War News Radio's Amy DiPiero explores how development and displacement in Iraqi Kurdistan are reshaping the common wisdom.
Since 2006, the Kurdistan Regional Government has marketed itself to investors and tourists as the other Iraq.
Have you seen the other Iraq? It's spectacular. It's joyful. It has an experienced security force.
The commercial begins with images of sweeping mountain vistas, then children running and a man holding Kurdistan's flag aloft. People are dancing, another man blows a horn. Kurdish soldiers salute the camera.
It's not a dream. It's the other Iraq.
After the United States invaded Iraq in 2003, Iraqi Kurdistan sought to attract tourists and investors with its relative stability and tolerance. While this strategy has helped to fund social projects and infrastructure in much of the region, Sporadic cross-border violence and a local patronage network contribute to vast economic inequality. With Sunni-Shiite tensions flaring in Baghdad since U.S. troops withdrew in December, can Kurdistan continue developing its own economy while federal Iraq falters? In December 2010, three reporters from the New York Times visited a shopping mall in Erbil, the capital of Iraqi Kurdistan. Here's reporter Anthony Shadid in a video they produced.
With its chrome escalators and fountains, this mall gleams like an advertisement for unhindered capitalism. The economy here is booming, and people have the means and desire to shop.
Denise Natali is the Minerva Fellow at the Institute for National Strategic Studies at National Defense University in Washington, D.C. She's not so enthusiastic about malls as a hallmark of development.
I don't get too excited about malls because you're also catering to a very select community of people.
But how about Erbil's airport, which boasts one of the world's longest runways? Here's another ad from Kurdistan's The Other Iraq campaign.
In the Kurdistan region of Iraq, investors aren't just building an airport.
We are building a democracy.
While acknowledging that airports and malls are necessary projects, Natali fears new construction is part of a real estate bubble. Rachel Stacey is a member of the Christian Peacemaker Teams, a service organization based in Chicago, which traveled to Iraqi Kurdistan in October 2011. CBT has been active in Iraq since 2002 and began working in the Kurdistan region in 2006. On this particular trip, Stacey's delegation visited a Kurdish village near the border with Iran. Each summer, the whole community relocates to an internally displaced persons, or IDP camp, to avoid cross-border shellings.
Their village is slowly dying, and yet the people that are there are the people that are coming back year after year after year.
Villages like this one are caught in the middle of violence new and old. While Iran targets Kurdish militants living in the mountains around the village every summer, residents must also dodge the remnants of the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s year-round.
There's landmines. And landmines, they say, I don't know if they're like kind of cliche, is it takes 5 cents to put one in the ground, and it takes $5,000 to dig one up. And a lot of the people there don't have $5,000.
And yet people return to this dangerous landscape every year. In some ways, Stacy says, they don't have a choice. The government requires they purchase small plots each year at the IDP camp, but they can't stay there full-time because
the government wouldn't allow them to build houses on their land.
Instead, the families pitched tents over small concrete foundations.
And they couldn't stay there when the weather turned cold because it was on this treeless plains, very arid land, and the wind would just rip through and the snow would fall.
Besides violence and an internal displacement problem, Natali also sees the Kurdistan regional government's patronage system as a source of this disparity.
The Kurdistan region was never a democracy and is not one now. So what you're having is deeply rooted patronage networks becoming further embedded and enriched. And so you have a small handful of people becoming extremely even more wealthy.
Natali says this economic divide can provoke social and even religious discord.
This is a very conservative society still. So you have to also look at not only the discrepancies in wealth, but the discrepancies in social and religious and living standards across the regions.
Despite this threat, Natali says Kurdistan's development since the early 1990s is substantial.
I first went in 1992, right after the war, and there was nothing. There wasn't electricity, there wasn't food. To see this development really is something.
For War News Radio at Lodge 6, I'm Amy DePiro.
That report comes to us from War News Radio. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. You can also find a regular column related to 51% at feminist.com. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.